Welcome to Glimpses of Calvary, and thank you for joining us. Glimpses of Calvary is a ministry of Calvary Baptist Church in Canyon City, Colorado. Join us now as our pastor, John McDonald, opens the Word of God to us.
Mark chapter 8. We'll be reading Mark chapter 8 and verses 34 through 38. Before we do that, we need to remember what's happened up to this point. We have had the ministry of Jesus uncovered, I think we could probably say, and declared openly. Up to this point, Jesus has been speaking in parables. He's not been beating around the bush. He's just cognizant of the timing of the revelation of who he is. And of course, we know that when this happens, and when he himself openly declares that he is the Messiah, it's all going to break loose here. And people are going to lose their collective minds. And it's going to result in, of course, the death of Christ on the cross for you and I. And so Jesus asks the disciples, who do men say that I am? And of course, there's all kinds of opinions about who Jesus is. Even among Christians, I find that to be rather odd. Don't confuse me with what the Bible says. I know what I believe. I've heard Christians say that. In fact, the wonderful thing, or the not so wonderful thing, or it's hard to say, about preaching through a book is sometimes you have to touch on certain subjects. And because they're in the Bible, you have to preach them. They're not comfortable. And for example, in Mark chapter 10, we get to talk about divorce and remarriage. Ooh, I saw everybody's eyebrows. Woo! I felt the breeze. And so I think that's one of the benefits of preaching verse by verse is because you don't have the luxury of skipping over or going around certain subject. So who do men say that I am? And all kinds of opinions were put forth. And then Jesus narrowed it down to his followers, his disciples. And Peter said that thou art the Christ. In Matthew, it's thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And of course, Peter nailed it. He got it right. And then Jesus said, you're right, Peter. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected of the elders and of the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. So, yes, Peter, you're right, and this is what I'm going to have to go through in order to fulfill that confession of yours, Peter. And then Peter rebuked God. So out of his mouth comes this wonderful confession, would be found on any Bible-believing list of doctrine regarding who the person of Jesus Christ is. And it would pass the test of a doctrinal scrutiny. And then Peter says, you're not going to do this, Lord. So in one verse, he's the propagator of the testimony of Christ. And in the very next verse, he's the enemy of God. So we better be careful, shouldn't we, about where we think we are on this road of spiritual progression. And then Jesus looked on his disciples and he rebuked Peter. Apparently Peter was presenting himself as the spokesman for the group. We don't know what was in the hearts of the other, but Jesus turns to them and rebukes Peter. And he says, "Get thee behind me, Satan." And so we come to verse 34. "And when he called the people unto him with his disciples also, he said unto them," so now he's gathered the whole group, not just the disciples, anyone who was within earshot, he says, "Come here, I want to tell you something. I got something I got to teach you." He says, "Whosoever will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And whosoever will save his life shall lose it. But whosoever shall lose his life for my sake and the gospel's, the same shall save it. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own or lose his soul? Whosoever therefore shall be ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he cometh in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." Last February the 4th, there was an event called the Super Bowl. Millions of people gathered in their living rooms and actually went to the game and saw the Philadelphia Eagles beat the Patriots, much to my delight. And I was curious to know what it would cost to see the game. And after a few moments of research, I discovered that there are no cheap seats for the Super Bowl. According to StubHub, the average price of a ticket to the Super Bowl, the average price is $5,309. Average. The highest priced in the last decade by a wide margin. And the get-in cost, just to get through the door, $3,000. And on the secondary market, Super Bowl 52 was more than $9,000 for one seat. And then they're not even throwing in hot dogs. And then parking, you have to pay to park, so $9,000. And so no matter how you slice it, it comes to the realization that it costs some big bucks to go to the Super Bowl. There are no cheap seats the Super Bowl. If you're a basketball fanatic, and of course the Final Four, I don't really follow it much until that last those last few games. The Final Four, if you want to attend that, in 2019, this is upcoming, so you'll want to start saving, okay? The range is between $500 to $1,430. And the $1,400 will buy you entrance into what they call the Final Four experience. And what is that? Well, you get to go in and get drunk and miss the game. You get to hobnob with some crotchety old players who used to be big in their day and now they're has-beens, and you get to pay a little extra for that. So there are no cheap seats for the upcoming Final Four. If you want to go to the Daytona 500, I like to watch racing. I've never actually been to a race. They're normally on Sunday. But if you want to go to the Daytona 500, minimum $250. Maximum $1,000. No cheap seats. You know what Jesus is trying to teach his disciples here? There are no cheap seats if you're going to follow me. No cheap seats. He wants us to know that there are no cheap seats in his service. He's just revealed who he is to his disciples, and he's just told them that he's going to have to die for their sins on the cross. And in that statement, he shattered every dream and notion that they had of who Jesus was. They came into this relationship with their own ideas about who Jesus was and what Jesus was going to do and where we, following him, are going to end up. Jesus was a public relations manager's nightmare. He'd start to build a crowd, and then all of a sudden he'd open his mouth and whittle them down to 12. There are no cheap seats in following Christ. By the way, it is a serious thing to make a profession of faith or to join a church, because in this verse, he shares a pattern for true discipleship that often does not only include joining a church or making a profession. Peter made a profession, didn't he? And in the next verse, get behind me, Satan. Peter, you don't understand. And so now Jesus is going to try to help them understand. He's going to try to help us understand today what it means to be a disciple. Not everyone who claims to be a Christian is truly a disciple of Jesus. I saw a phrase this morning, I think it was. Building a church and building a crowd, two different things. Two totally different things. And those who would be his disciples, his followers, he lays out a pattern. He shares a pattern for what a disciple is. Four, if you will, requirements that they must meet in this life. And we're not talking about things you do in order to be saved. We're talking about things that show up if you are saved. And I understand that these things reveal themselves in varying degrees, but they should be there. And yes, as was shared in the Sunday school class this morning, we struggle with the flesh in these areas. That's why it's called a cross. The cross doesn't improve the man, it kills him. So when Jesus says taking up the cross, we're talking about ending something, not improving it. And there's too much of the cross preaching that's going along the lines of improvement. No, it's death. And so, this pattern, first of all, he says, whosoever will come after me. You don't get to lead the parade. You're following. Come after me. Surely his men, when Jesus said this, remembered when he first called them to follow him. I remember him calling Matthew. The Bible says he left all and he followed him. What does all mean? And all means, we learned that in Sunday school. They left everything and to the rest of the crowd that day. This was a call to the new birth. It was a call to make a personal commitment to Jesus Christ. It was a call for them to turn their backs on everything else and go after Jesus. Being born again, being saved, the new birth, whatever it is you want to call it, is far more than just praying a prayer. I've been with people who were so zealous to get people saved, and you could tell the person that was praying the prayer was praying it to get the guy off the doorstep. He's no more saved than the step he prayed the prayer on. You can pray the sinner's prayer all day and not get saved. You can walk the Romans road, and you can take a journey through John and still not be a believer. Being born again is about being made a new creation, according to 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 17. And only God creates. The Baptist Church doesn't create anything. God is the creator of heaven, earth, and he brings about this new creation. You can pray the sinner's prayer. You can get... You only get saved when God convicts you and draws you to Himself. And by the way, He doesn't just select certain people to draw to Himself. He's died for everyone. And everyone has an opportunity to receive Christ. So true salvation, however, is not this idea of just believing that leaves you unchanged. I've seen people, there they are with the bottle on one hand and the pack of cigarettes over here and the filthy magazine over there. Yeah, I was saved when I was 12. No, you weren't. You go down to this nursery down here on 9th Street and you buy a pear tree and you plant it and apples pop out. You better go down and demand a refund because you paid for an apple tree or a pear tree, right? No, the fruit of the Spirit, it's the Spirit's fruit that is produced in our lives as genuine believers in Jesus Christ. Again, we can have all the right words. And what I find it interesting is that Peter opposed Christ at the moment he felt that he was losing something for following Jesus. But in reality, you follow Jesus knowing you're going to lose it all. Do you see, that's the thing. So come after me. To the lost person, it's a call to be saved. Are you saved? To the saved person, it's a call to radical commitment. Are you totally and completely, radically following? And by the way, any person who's serious about following Jesus in our culture is going to be radical. So you need to get over this thing of what are people going to think. Because if you just even minimally follow Jesus in our culture, you're going to be a radical nutcake. I'm not saying we should look minimal, but I'm just saying that if you truly are a follower of Jesus Christ, you are a... Look, any old dead fish can float down the river. The live ones fight their way up. And that's what it is to be a committed disciple of Christ in our world today. A live fish fighting his way up the stream. So come after me. And then here's the one we'd just love to hear. Deny himself. Deny himself. It means to completely disown, to utterly separate oneself from someone. It's the same word used to describe Peter's denial of Jesus outside the high priest's home in Matthew chapter 26 and verse 34. Now, self-denial is not the same, or denying self is not the same as self-denial. Now, some people will practice self-denial by withholding certain things from themselves, like some high church people do during Lent. I'm going to give up chocolate during Lent. And they're not denying self. They're inflating self. Hey, look what I did. It's the opposite. Denying self is far more intense than that. Denying self implies that I stop. Now, here it is. I stop listening to me. I spend a tremendous amount of time preparing for the services, listening to God. You know what a conflict goes on in the soul and in the heart and the mind? God, me, God, me, God, me. And hopefully, by the time 10:45 rolls around, it's all God and none of me. But I'm just going to drop something in your lap today, okay? I want you to feel my pain. When I come out of that office and it's the battle has been all God, none of me, and I meet you, and it's all you and none of God, we have a problem. Do you know who's behind that? You know, if it's important that I get alone with God and hear His voice and not mine, It's just as important for you to do that before you get here and hear what's coming behind this pulpit. That's what it means to be a disciple. We don't go to church and have the pastor carry our cross for us. The Bible says, deny yourself. Some of us, we take Sunday morning as an opportunity to just... I haven't talked to anybody about me all week. So now here's an opportunity. No, it's not. It's an opportunity to talk about Jesus. Deny himself. That's really a concept that's foreign in our day, isn't it? You know, most religions and most popular ministries are focused on catering to self. The felt need philosophy. We find out what people need and we give it to them. That's not the Bible way. They want to build up people's self-esteem. Look, it's important to have a better God esteem. And when we see God for who he is and we see ourselves for who we are, then he says, take up his cross. You notice the word his cross. I preached a message a number of years ago on the Christian's cross. I had to run back and find it and print it out. And I got to thinking about, a lot of times we think our cross, you know, well, that's my cross to bear. Have you ever heard that phrase? Well, that's my cross to bear. Well, what do we usually mean when we say that? What we mean when we say that is, I have this investment called a property, a house, and I've put a lot of work into it. I've invested a lot of money and time and effort into it. And then this yahoo moves in next door to me and throws his beer cans over his fence into my yard. And I take on this attitude, well, that's just my cross to bear. You don't get to count that as a cross. You know what it would, the equivalent of a cross would be? Is if you knew that guy threw his beer cans into your yard and you bought the property anyway. See, that's cross bearing. See, a cross is something that you choose. It's a burden you put on yourself. It's not how you get trapped in a corner and no one else will do it. Well, I'll count that as my cross. No. You don't get to count that. Do you know that the cross that Christ bore was yours? And he bore it willingly. He chose it. I look back over my life and the years I've been saved, and I'm ashamed to say there are a lot of crosses that I've run away from. Because I didn't have the time or the money or the patience. Cross-bearing looks for an opportunity to bear a burden. Well, who does that? That's in their right mind. Most of us run from burdens, don't we? What's our complaint? I've got enough on my plate. No, the Christian's cross is piling something else on a plate that's already full. By the way, most of what's on that plate shouldn't be there to begin with. It's a choice. I freely choose this burden. Therefore doth my Father love me because I lay down my life. Nobody took his life, he gave it. Cross-bearing isn't somebody intruding on your calendar or your clock and taking time away from you. No, cross-bearing is you take time you don't have and give it. Freely. I'm crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ live within me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. This cross is also a choice that is made in fidelity to a relationship. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. You know what it meant when you saw someone hanging on a cross? back in the first century? I'm going to give it to you in a phrase. When you walked by and you saw a criminal on a cross, whether they were actually a committer of the crime or not, this is what that man hanging there said: Rome is right, I'm wrong. You know what a Christian, when they take up their cross, do you know what they're saying? God's right, I'm wrong. But too many times we have this battle. Isn't that what Peter? No, not so, Lord. No. That's not what I had in mind. You're not, God, that's not right. No, Peter. He's right. You're wrong. And here comes the cross bearing. Here comes the public relations nightmare. Anytime Jesus brought up the cross, it just seemed like the crowd shrunk. It's almost you follow these disciples, and he's working miracles, and they get a following, and they get a crowd, and they get a scribe to come and say, I want to follow you. And Jesus says, hey, wait a minute, you know, the foxes and the birds, they're going to have a place to lay their head, but you follow me, you're not going to have so much as a rock to put your head on. And he went away sorrowful. And the disciples, can't you just see him back there? Oh, not the cross message again! Just when we were getting popular and who wouldn't want a scribe? It was a choice, decision made in freedom. It was a choice made in fidelity to a relationship and a conviction. And thirdly, the cross, the Christian's cross, it's a choice to assume someone else's burden. When Jesus went to the cross, he was under your load by his choice. You really just can't get a better definition for what a cross is. Their load by my choice. It's kind of like that. You're late for that meeting, yet you see that car off the side of the road, and they obviously need help changing the tire. There's a struggle there, isn't there? Do I make my meeting, or do I burden myself? By the way, every opportunity to help somebody is an open door to share the gospel. Because nobody that you take their burden on yourself is going to totally and completely tune you out when you give them a gospel. The gospel. That's why I love talking to waitresses. They're serving you. They're open. They might be selfish, and that might be a bigger tip if I listen to them. I'll take advantage of every opportunity I have. Deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. You know, to follow something, you have to leave something. Following, by definition, is leaving. By definition. You cannot follow unless you leave. And everybody's following something. And by definition, everyone's leaving something. You know, the world says you can follow Jesus and you can have this too. Mm-mm. You know, a man on the cross didn't have any plans for tomorrow. I mean, he's not up there on the cross saying, hey, would you pencil a meeting with the doctor for next week into my day timer? No. There are no future. There's no future plans. The person on the cross, follow me. It's just amazing what people will follow. And this idea, the phrase, follow me, it's an ongoing action. The verbiage, the verb there, it's an ongoing following. It's not just for 2 hours on Sunday and then I go back to my priority. No. It's not a huge strain on your spirituality to come into church on Sunday morning. Why? Because you've been practicing that all week. In fact, I just be honest with you, the sweetest services are those who are filled with people who have been building up to that moment. The ones that are difficult are you're trying to drag people into the mindset of following. That's hard. It's a spiritual battle. There are no cheap things or seats in this thing called Christianity. It's just hard. So he shares a pattern, then he shares a paradox. He says in verse 35, if you're going to save your life, you're going to have to lose it. A paradox is a statement that seems contradictory, but is still true. You have a choice. You can live your life as you see fit. You can refuse to come to Jesus Christ for salvation. You can call the shots. You can be your own boss. You can do as you please. You know how many people I've talked to about coming to church on Sunday, and they say, it's the only way I have to do what I want. It's the only day I have. But you know what? Would you give up one day for an eternity of days? Do you know how foolish that statement is going to seem when that person closes their eyes in death? And for all of eternity, they wished they had given God one day. And really, it's not the only day they have. They've just taken the other days to themselves in a different way. They're deceived. In the economy of God, losers are keepers. Those who lose their lives by giving them up for Christ are winners. In the end, while those who live for this life alone lose everything in the end. Verse 36, he asks a powerful question. For what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world? I think he can boil down the desire to be rich in one simple principle. People want to be rich not because of money per se, but what money brings. And this is, I've heard this from the lips of more than one very rich person. I get to do what I want, and I get to do it when I want to do it. So that's what they do. They spend their life doing what they want, and when they want to do it. Imagine if you possess the whole world. By the way, you don't have to possess the whole world. You know, $1 million doesn't go very far in Manhattan. If you're a millionaire and you have $1 million in Manhattan, you're not rich. $1 million will go a long way in Pit Lick, Arkansas. I mean, you can. So you might, within your sphere of influence or whatever, your station in life, you might be able to do what you want and when you want. And this idea of just being able to do, be, get anything you want. And imagine that you are the absolute ruler of all things material in your life. Now, you know, that sounds pretty good. But now imagine at the end of that experience of having and being and doing as you please that you die. And now imagine that after death you find yourself in hell forever. Forever. Hell. Forever. Now, there's a Bible story. It's not a story. It's an actual event. Luke 16, 19 through 31, the rich man and Lazarus. The Bible tells us the rich man fared sumptuously every day. And in that life, he was the be, do, and buy anything I want, have whatever I want. And the Bible says that he closed his eyes in death. And it says in hell, from the moment he died, lifted up his eyes, being in torment. Yet Lazarus was comforted in Abraham's bosom. What is the worth of your soul? Hey, would you give me your eyeball for $1 million? Anybody here want to give up an eyeball for $1 million? You're thinking about it. I can buy a lot of eye patches for $1 million. Huh? You know why most people wouldn't do that? Because your eyes are valuable. You know what Jesus says? If your eye offends you, pluck it out. Cast it. Cast it away from you. It'd be better to go into eternity and to heaven with one eye than to hell with both. And so what he's saying is, as valuable as your eye is, how much more valuable is your soul? You can't put a price on the soul. It's valuable. It's so valuable that God robed himself in human flesh and died on a cross to purchase it. In fact, it's so valuable, I think the word is priceless. Your soul's priceless. There's nothing in this life that is worth losing it and giving for it. About 1000 AD, a tomb was opened. The tomb of Charlemagne, Charles I, I think it was. Who was Charles I? Well, he united Europe, East and West. And I want to read to you what I found in a book online, a description of what they did. Charlemagne was entombed, according to his request, in a vault below the center of the dome of a church. But here his remains do not repose at the present day. His remains have been moved more than one time. Had this monarch contented himself with going down into the dust like the rest of his fellow creatures, he would have stood a fair chance of being left to dissolve into the original elements of humanity. But he didn't do that. Unfortunately, however, for his posthumous repose, he chose to be buried in all the magnificence of his robes of state. He was buried sitting on his throne. As if still, though in his dreary dungeon tomb, ruling the destinies of half the world. It was not in the nature of things that his majesty should be allowed to sit forever in this condition of costly splendor. Otto III, Emperor of Germany, visited the spot probably at the time he ordered the restoration of the edifice and causing the tomb to be opened. They found the skeleton of Charlemagne sitting on the throne, which it had been placed at his death in 814, 200 years later. They found the skeletal remains of King Charlemagne sitting on his throne with his crown on his skull. And in his lap was a copy of the Gospels. On the fleshless skull there was stuck a crown which he had worn during life. A scepter was fastened in his right hand. A jeweled mantle of state was thrown over his shoulders. A copy of the Gospels was carefully placed upon his knees. A sword was buckled to his side. And to his girdle was hung the pilgrim's pouch, which he had borne when alive as a token of Christian piety. Otto forthwith removed these valuable things and left his bones in there and shut the door. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world? He buried with a scepter in his hand, a crown on his head, and a sword around his waist, and the gospel's on his knees, and lose his soul. I don't know where Charlemagne is today. But wherever it is, it's far more important than any king's desire to be buried in a kingly repose. Because once Charlemagne closed his eyes in death, he ruled nothing. Nothing. I had an opportunity to witness to a man yesterday. He said, I'm a firefighter, I'm a paramedic. I've seen too many horrible things. He says, I've seen an innocent 3-year-old girl die horribly in a car wreck. He says, I find it hard to believe. An innocent 3-year-old. I said, well, what about an innocent man choosing to die for you? How fair. And that's the word he used. He says, it just doesn't seem fair. I said, you know, there was a man almost 2,000 years ago, an innocent man, who went to a cross and he took your place. How fair is that? You know, ultimately what he was talking about was death. He saw the death. I said, my friend, the wages of sin is death. We're all going to die. We don't get to choose the date of our death. I said, but my friend, Jesus has taken care of the last enemy. And the enemy is not, I can't understand that question. No, the enemy is death. Because after death, my friend, you'll know all the answers. It would be helpful to know some before you died. It got real quiet in that conversation that we had. You could tell the wheels were turning. Pray for him. His name's Shane. What would it profit a man if he gained the whole world and lose his own soul? The value of the soul will come into view when you deny yourself. The value of another soul, we were talking about that. That's amazing how the Sunday school and the message today are just sort of dovetailing, right? Do you know why we don't treat people with compassion? Because we don't value them like God does. Do you know why we're not followers of Jesus as we should? Because we don't value things the way God does. We value other things over, and it's actually the reverse. It's got to be a rearrangement of our priorities.